the headlines. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the scandals follow Donald Trump as the U.S. president shows that bullying, racism, and lawlessness are doomed to failure.
On this vote, the yeas are 223, the nays are 205. The resolution is adopted.
The U.S. House of Representatives votes to urge Vice President Mike Pence to invoke a constitutional amendment to remove President Donald Trump from office. And the United States sits a record of nearly 4,500 deaths from the novel coronavirus in a single day. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the U.S. is suffering from a major political divide following an attack by President Donald Trump's supporters on Congress.
The American nation is experiencing a major failure in its social and political life, a deep divide inside the country. As we said before, an unlawful person who violates rules in dealing with suppressed and independent nations will one day do the same with his own nation.
Rouhani said the breach of the U.S. Congress was unprecedented. He said the American nation has never imagined that their president would encourage such violence. Rouhani said the scandalous fall of Trump as the U.S. president shows that bullying, racism, and lawlessness are doomed to failure. The Iranian president also said the so-called U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. He said the Iranian people have remained strong despite sanctions and pressure. Rouhani added the country has achieved economic growth in the past months. The Iranian Navy has launched its biggest ever military vessel and expeditionary transfer dock, domestically built for large-scale logistic movements. The mobile base ship joined the Navy in the presence of Chairman of Iran's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Baghari, on the first day of a maritime drill. She's named Makran after a southern Iranian coastal stretch and is capable of carrying five helicopters on her deck. The ship will support Iranian naval fleets in the northern part of the Indian Ocean, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and the Red Sea. The Iranian Navy also received a missile destroyer called Zereh, meaning armor. Tuman Abedi has given us more details about the two vessels from Konarak, a port city in southeastern Iran where the ships joined the Navy.
Makran, let me tell you that it originally was a trade ship, but within 6 months the army worked on it and turned it into a kind of auxiliary ship or a support ship. It is 228 meters long and it is 121,000 tons. You know, it can carry about a battalion of forces, and also it can carry about 82,000 tons of needed facilities for the fleet at sea. Within the next stage of its development, a moving hospital would also be established on it. And it is so big that they call it a kind of floating port. The other vessel that joined the Iranian Navy today in the presence of top commanders was this one, which is called Zereh. Zereh is a kind of corvette or vessel. As you can see, it is a weaponized vessel. It has got two artilleries, one in the top, one in the front, and one in the back. And it is equipped with electronic warfare devices as well. And a missile launcher is also set on it.
The House of Representatives in the U.S. has approved a resolution that urges Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Donald Trump from office.
On this vote, the yeas are 223, the nays are 205. The resolution is adopted.
The measure was passed with a final vote of 223 to 205. Pence has said he would not invoke the 25th Amendment. He said the move is not in the best interests of the nation. House Democrats said they will vote on Trump's impeachment on Thursday if the article is not invoked. The impeachment would address charges of inciting insurrection after Trump's supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol last Wednesday, with that Trump would be the first president in U.S. history to face impeachment twice. He has downplayed the risk of being removed from office.
Respect for law enforcement and the great people within law enforcement. So many are here. And I'd like to say that free speech is under assault like never before. The 25th Amendment is of zero risk to me, but will come back to haunt Joe Biden and the Biden administration. As the expression goes, be careful what you wish for.
Trump also called the Democratic-led efforts to bring impeachment charges against him a witch hunt, a phrase he had repeatedly used during his first impeachment. Earlier, he described the initiative by the Democrats as a dangerous move. The developments come as Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has reportedly said the president has committed impeachable offenses. Several House Republicans have also voiced support for the impeachment. International lawyer Edward Corrigan says the U.S. House will definitely pass the impeachment vote against President Trump.
Well, I think the impeachment vote will definitely pass at the House of Representatives because the Democrats have a narrow majority there, but there's an indication of a number of Republicans that are going to join them. Mm. The Senate, the Republicans still have a majority until there's the transfer of power on January 20th. And then it'll be tied, and then Vice President will have the tie-breaking vote. Mm. But there's some people, one senator for Alaska, Lisa Macrosky, said that she doesn't see herself as a Republican under the Trump administration. And Trump really has a cult, and he has done a tremendous amount of damage. And he's trying to just, you know, sort of have a total reign of destruction for the last couple of weeks of his power. And this is unprecedented. People were afraid that Richard Nixon might break before he resigned with the impeachment thing with Watergate and whatever.
Right.
But he did resign. He was pressured into that. Mm-hmm. But people were afraid that he was becoming mentally unstable. And I think the same concerns actually are even larger with Donald Trump.
U.S. National Guard troops deployed on the streets of the capital, Washington, D.C., have been allowed to carry weapons. The Guard soldiers were also authorized to make arrests if the situation got out of hand. That's according to the Pentagon National Guard Bureau Chief. Daniel Hokinson, however, said it would be a last resort. U.S. officials are boosting security ahead of the inauguration of Joe Biden as president on January the 20th. It comes in the wake of the last week breach of Congress by supporters of President Donald Trump. Five people were killed as a result. The FBI has warned of armed protests at all 50 state capitals and in Washington before Inauguration Day. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has pledged to strengthen his country's nuclear arsenal.
While strengthening our nuclear war deterrent, we need to do everything in order to build the most powerful military.
Kim made the remarks in his closing address to a top ruling Workers' Party meeting that lasted 8 days. He called the U.S. the foremost principal enemy of North Korea and the fundamental obstacle to the development of its revolution. Kim said the real intention of Washington's policy towards Pyongyang will never change, regardless of who is in power in the U.S. The two sides held summits in 2018 and 19 that aimed to lift sanctions against North Korea in return for its denuclearization. However, the last summit in February 2019 broke down and talks have remained deadlocked since then. Daily COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. have hit a new record with nearly 4,500 fatalities. According to data released by Johns Hopkins University, cumulative deaths in the world's worst hit country have now surpassed 380,000. The average number of daily deaths in the past week has now surpassed the fatalities of the 9/11 attack. The U.S. has also so far registered more than 22.8 million cases of the virus. Over the past week, an average of nearly 249,000 new COVID-19 infections was reported every day. Vaccination is also underway in the country, but the government has come under criticism for the program's slow and chaotic process. China has expanded its COVID-19 restrictions after a sharp spike in infections. A state of emergency has been declared in the northeastern province of Heilongjiang, where over 37 million people live. Residents there are not allowed to leave the province. Also in four northern cities, over 20 million people have been put under lockdown. On Wednesday, China confirmed 115 new COVID cases. That's the highest daily increase since late July. The country last year managed to bring under control its coronavirus outbreak with tight restrictions and a robust contact tracing system. Stephen Rabane, Beijing, says a COVID spike in Heilongjiang has caused nervousness in the largely unaffected Chinese capital as the province is close to Beijing.
One of the four prefecture-level cities under lockdown in China is in Heilongjiang, and the other three are in Hebei, which is the province that surrounds the capital, Beijing. So there is a bit of nervousness now, because from the get-go, China was very sensitive to instability in its capital. And the capital, as a result, had tighter restrictions than anywhere else in the country that was unaffected by the virus, or largely unaffected. For example, if you left the capital and you came back, you had to subject yourself to quarantine. I mean, even if you just go outside Beijing, you'd have to submit yourself to 14 days when you came back. But having said that, China has a tried, tested, proven, very well-oiled system now, apparatus, in place for containing this disease. In addition to lockdowns in these four prefecture-level cities, there are about 28 million people under lockdown now. There's mass testing. In Shijiazhuang, they're now testing millions of people. There's probably, most importantly, though, is tracking.
E-legislators claim there is a lack of clarity and transparency surrounding the European Union's vaccine strategy. Member states in the 27-nation bloc are accused of not moving quickly enough to administer COVID-19 jabs, as Jerome Hughes reports.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we need maximum information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Indonesia has temporarily suspended a search by divers for the cockpit voice recorder of an airliner that crashed into the sea on Saturday. The search in the Java Sea was halted due to bad weather. Officials say a remotely operated underwater vehicle will be deployed to scour the seabed. Divers have already retrieved the plane's flight data recorder and found the beacon attached to the cockpit voice recorder. Investigators need the two black boxes to discover why the Sriwijaya Air's Boeing 737 crashed. 62 people were aboard the plane when it crashed shortly after takeoff from Jakarta's main airport. Its crew had reported no emergency or technical problems. Israel has launched fresh airstrikes on Syria, targeting the country's eastern parts. Near the Iraqi border, informed sources have told Press TV that several people were wounded in the Israeli strikes. Last week, the Syrian Air Defense reported another Israeli attack on the capital, Damascus. Israel has stepped up its aerial attacks on Syria in the past few months. That is seen as a reaction to the Syrian government's victories against foreign-backed militants. Some of the militant groups are said to be backed by Israel. Damascus has called on the United Nations to take decisive measures to prevent Tel Aviv from repeating similar offenses. Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip have slammed UN cuts to aid and services provided to them. The majority of Gazans are refugees who were kicked out of their towns and villages upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948. Nasser Shannon has more of this report.
Palestinian refugees demonstrated in the Gaza Strip against UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. They protested the agency's cuts to vital services, aid, and employment. The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. More than 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip and rely on UNRWA aid to survive.
We will stand up against all the conspiracies targeting the Palestinian people and their cause. These cuts are part of the so-called deal of the century. As we stand here, we issue a strong warning to UNRWA against these cuts that aim to end the refugees' issues.
UNRWA is a United Nations agency established by the General Assembly decades ago and mandated to provide assistance to Palestinian refugees. According to UNRWA, there are over 5 million registered Palestinian refugees.
We are already suffering because of the Israeli blockade, and our countries must stand with Palestinian refugees. UNRWA cuts are hurting all Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA cuts come at the worst times because they come amid the coronavirus pandemic and a dire humanitarian situation. The refugees have been suffering for many years before the eyes of the international community.
The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis worsened after U.S. President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018. The crisis of Palestinian refugees began in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land.
Palestinian refugees say that UNRWA cuts will only increase their suffering after more than 7 decades of displacement. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Limelight. Trump could be charged with solicitation to commit a crime of violence, that is murder, under 18 U.S.C. Sect 373. It is a crime to solicit, command, induce, or endeavor to persuade another person to commit a felony involving the threat or use of physical force. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Marjorie Kahn Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump can be indicted under federal, state, and DC laws for his role in January 6th. Here's the details. The legal evidence is damning. Donald Trump should be held criminally liable for seditious conspiracy and inciting insurrection for his role in stoking the events of January 6th, when an angry mob of Trump loyalists, incited by the president himself, stormed the Capitol building to stop the congressional counting of voters for Joe Biden in the Electoral College. The mob easily breached the Capitol building, rampaged through the halls of Congress, some waving Confederate flags, terrorizing senators and Congress members. In stark contrast to the overwhelming and violent police force used against the largely peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters, there was little resistance offered by law enforcement against Trump's mostly white minions as they entered the building where Congress was meeting and tore it apart. Trump's violent backers did temporarily hold a count of votes for Biden. Five people died, and the mob of Trump supporters sprayed chemicals through lead pipes and injured more than 50 officers. Hours later, Trump released a videotape message praising them. "We love you. You're very special." He gave them permission to go home. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is right to be pursuing efforts to remove Trump from the presidency through the 25th Amendment, but that effort hit a roadblock today as House Republicans refused to give unanimous consent to a resolution urging Vice President Mike Pence to initiate the process. That means the House will vote on the resolution, which is expected to pass easily. Even if, as expected, Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment procedure, Democrats can still press ahead with efforts to impeach and convict Trump, so as to bar him from holding future federal office. In the weeks that follow, Trump may also be charged with the commission of several federal and even state crimes. After January 20th, Trump will no longer be shielded by the Department of Justice policy that a sitting president cannot be indicted. There is overwhelming evidence that Trump committed several crimes. The Constitution gives the president pardon power but says nothing about self-pardons. Trump has discussed pardoning himself. Since no president has ever done that, it is not clear whether a self-pardon would withstand a legal challenge if the Biden administration were to mount one. In any event, Trump does not have the power to pardon state crimes. Thus, wherever possible, federal cases should be filed jointly with prosecutions under D.C. law and laws in states such as Virginia and Maryland, where many Trump loyalists stayed, and in their home states as well. Trump violated 18 U.S.C. Sect 2383, which prohibits incitement of rebellion or insurrection. It provides for 10 years in prison for anyone who incites any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or the laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto. If convicted of this crime, Trump shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. The evidence cited in the pending article of impeachment also supports the criminal charge of inciting rebellion or insurrection against Trump. Trump also committed seditious conspiracy in violation of 18 U.S.C. Sect 2384, but conspiring to oppose by force the authority of the government and by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States. Seditious conspiracy carries a 20-year prison sentence. Interrupting the counting of the electoral votes constitutes delaying the execution of U.S. law. During the January 6th siege, Rudy Giuliani left a long voicemail meant for Senator Tommy Tuberville, urging him to slow down the vote certification in the Electoral College. It reached Senator Mike Lee instead. In a 10-minute phone conversation with Tuberville, Trump implored him to make additional objections to the vote count. Trump apparently resisted calling in the National Guard, which ultimately arrived once the Capitol breach was well underway. Trump loyalists quickly found the offices of specific legislators, including Nancy Pelosi. They went directly to Representative James Clyburn, private office, which few people knew about that, leading Michael Moore to speculate that congresspersons were on the conspiracy. Giuliani, Donald Trump Jr., and Representative Mo Brooks, together with Trump, conspired to exhort the large crowd to stop the counting of votes in the Electoral College, which is a U.S. law contained in the Constitution. Over a period of several weeks, people close to Trump encouraged and advertised the wild January 6th event. Moreover, White House counsel Pat Cipollone told White House officials not to talk to Trump or assist his coup attempt so they would not be prosecuted for treason. Trump could also be charged with solicitation to commit a crime of violence, that is murder, under 18 U.S.C. Sect 373. It is a crime to solicit, command, induce, or endeavor to persuade another person to commit a felony involving the threat or use of physical force. If prosecutors can prove that whomever killed Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick was incited to violence at the rally where Trump exhorted his followers, he could be convicted of inciting murder. Legal grounds also exist for charging Trump in Georgia for having solicited Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to commit election fraud. In a January 2nd phone call, Trump bullied the Georgia Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes to overturn Biden's win in that state and threatened Raffensperger if he didn't comply. Trump can be charged with criminal solicitation to commit election fraud in Georgia state court. For months before the presidential election, Trump spewed false claims of fraud to preemptively discredit a Biden victory. Both before and after Biden won 306 electoral votes, far more than 270 required to win. Trump filed frivolous lawsuits challenging their results. Judge after judge dismissed them, and the Supreme Court refused to overturn the election. Trump pressured election officials in several states to refuse to certify duly chosen Biden electors. And he sought to disenfranchise people of color in targeted countries and jurisdictions with primarily black or brown populations. For weeks, White House staff and Trump's close allies planned and promoted the Stop the Steal protest on January 6th at the Capitol. Big protest in D.C. on January 6th, Trump tweeted on December 19th, "Be there, we'll be wild." Since Pence would be presiding over the joint session of Congress on January 6th, Trump applied tremendous pressure on him to stop the certification of Biden's electoral votes. When Pence told Trump that the Constitution gave him no such power, Trump was furious. On January 6th, Trump and his co-conspirators Giuliani, Trump Jr., and Brooks egged on the assembled crowd, urging them to march to the Capitol and stop the constitutionally mandated electoral vote count. Giuliani told the throng, "Let's have trial but combat." Trump Jr. yelled, "Stand up and fight," and threatened congressional Republicans who were not trying to overturn the election, declaring, "We are coming for you." Brooks said, "Today is the day American patriots start taking down names," adding, "Our ancestors sacrificed their blood, their sweat, their tears, their fortunes, and sometimes their lives to give us their descendants, an America that is the greatest nation in the world history." He then asked the audience if they were willing to do the same. When Trump addressed the crowd, he called the election outcome this egregious assault on U.S. democracy. He said they would stop the steal and keep the Democrats from fraudulently taking over our country. Trump advised his supporters to show strength and walk down to the Capitol, adding, "You will never take back our country with weakness." He said, "When you catch somebody in a fraud, you are allowed to go by very different rules." They followed Trump's extortion and carried out the most destructive attack on Congress and the process of democratic elections in the U.S. history. Trump's seditious conduct should result in his removal from office under the 25th Amendment, and barring that, he should be impeached. Introduced by Democratic Representatives David Cicilline, Ted Leo, and Jamie Raskin, the article alleges that Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by willfully inciting violence against the government of the United States. Shortly before the Senate and House of Representatives met to count the Electoral College votes, Trump reiterated false claims to a nearby crowd of his supporters, telling them, "We won this election, and we won it by a landslide." The article says Trump also willfully made statements that encouraged and foreseeably resulted in imminent lawless action at the Capitol. The allegations continue. In addition, the article cites Trump's prior efforts to subvert and obstruct the certification of the results of the 2020 presidential election. They include his January 2nd phone call to Raffensperger, during which Trump urged him to find enough votes to overturn Georgia presidential election results and threatened Raffensperger if he failed to do so. The article states that Trump gravely endangered the security of the United States and its government institutions. threatened the integrity of the democratic system, interfered with the peaceful transition of power, and imperiled a coordinate branch of government. Trump thereby betrayed his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Finally, the article says, Trump will remain a threat to national security, democracy, and the Constitution if he continues in office. One way or another, Trump should be removed from office and prevented from running for president again in 2024. He must be criminally charged to ensure accountability and prevent impunity for his egregious crimes to deter future presidential lawbreaking.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Israel once again has been accused of being an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian lands. Human rights groups say that Israel has created a system over all the territory in which Jews have full rights. Palestinians are divided into tiers with different levels of rights, but always below those of the Jews. Now, Tel Aviv has effective control over the Gaza Strip, which it has blockaded since 2006. In the West Bank, Palestinians live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and devoid of political rights and security. They're also facing the dangers and risks of living under occupation. Stay for a debate on the issue.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the advancement of a plan to build over 800 more settler units in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu's office says the units will be constructed in several settlement complexes. It, however, failed to determine a starting date for the project. The announcement comes in defiance of international law, which considers all Israeli settlements on occupied land as illegal. Even multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions have failed to deter Tel Aviv from its expansionist agenda. Many Palestinians say Netanyahu is using U.S. President Donald Trump's remaining days in office to push ahead with his settlement ambitions.
Netanyahu and his regime are racing against time. They are using the time when U.S. President Donald Trump was in a presidency to approve more settlement projects and settlement units. And this is what happens today. Before the inauguration of the new American administration, Netanyahu has approved the building.
Palestinians have for decades expressed their anger and concern over the seizure of their lands and turning them into settler units. They have been demanding the international community to put a halt to Israel's settlement plans. In a latest push, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh said the international community should oblige the Israeli occupying regime to stop its colonial projects in Palestine. The Premier said the continued settlement activities show Israel's disregard for international laws and statutes. However, many see the Israeli settlement expansion in a much broader context. On Monday, an Israeli-based rights advocacy NGO accused Tel Aviv of being an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy on the occupied land. Betzalem said Israel has created a system in all occupied territories where Jewish people have full rights. The group that documents human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied territories says Palestinians in the West Bank live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and without political rights.
You know, there's an international convention on the crime of apartheid and racial discrimination, which specifically says that people living in the same country should not be subjected to different sets of laws. And that's how it defines apartheid.
But what really gives the Israeli regime the courage to pursue the policy of oppression against Palestinians? Many say Washington's unconditional support for the Israeli regime is to blame. Donald Trump has been a staunch supporter of Netanyahu's settlement policy in the occupied territories. But given Israel's settlement expansions and its pursuance of the so-called Jewish supremacy agenda, the question arises whether the new U.S. administration will be any different to its predecessor in stopping Tel Aviv's apartheid policies, or will it turn a blind eye to them as it has been doing in the past 7 decades.
Let's get us started. Joining me will be human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and award-winning Palestinian journalist Daoud Katab from Amman. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Daniel. Drawing a comparison between apartheid in South Africa and Israel, observers argue that the Israeli apartheid in occupied Palestine is more militaristic and more brutal, while in the South Africa, the blacks were never blockaded or killed, as Tel Aviv is doing in the case of the Palestinians. Do you agree?
I do. And so does, by the way, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who won the Nobel Prize. Of course, he's from South Africa. He's made that observation. In fact, I think even to call it apartheid is to understate the situation. I've been saying for a while that really this is a process of genocide. You know, look at what's happening with the coronavirus immunizations. Israel's giving it to Jews there, but not giving it to Palestinians. I mean, that's incredible. They're the occupying force. They have to make sure under international law, under international humanitarian law, that people get proper, you know, water, food, medical attention, which would include these immunizations. Israel's not only refusing to guarantee these things, they're preventing people in Palestine from getting these things, dumping sewage into farmland, into fresh water. This is an act of genocide.
Right. Now, turning to Amman, Daoud, how do you describe the lives of millions of Palestinians living under the ongoing Israeli occupation?
Well, occupation is clearly a different rule for Israel. I think the reason the apartheid is listed as a war crime. With the South African struggle against apartheid, the international community agreed to list apartheid as a war crime according to international humanitarian law. And so that's why you see a lot of usage of the term, and that's why you see the Israelis rejecting the term, because the moment that they accept the existence of apartheid, they basically concede that they are committing an ongoing war crime, because the settlements and the settlers are not supposed to be moved to occupied areas. The fact that you have settlers who are Israeli citizens who live under Israeli civilian law, living side by side with Palestinians who have no political rights and are under military law, you have a two-system situation. And so that's what apartheid is all about.
Daniel, apparently it's only Europe that's still denying the Israeli practice of this apartheid system in spite of overwhelming evidence of that effect. What's behind the Europeans' denial of this fact?
Well, because if they admitted it, they would be required to do something about it. You know, I mean, the irony, of course, is that Europe and the U.S., Canada always talk about the need to engage in humanitarian intervention in other countries to guarantee human rights and humanitarian law. If they admitted how bad the situation was for Palestine, they would have to act under their own arguments, you know? If any place in the world calls for some sort of humanitarian intervention, it would be in Palestine to protect them from Israel. And so, you know, you see the West downplaying how brutally the Palestinians are being treated for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Daoud, as Daniel mentioned, the Europeans need to do something about it if they admit that the plight of the Palestinians, and they are doing something about it. You know what they're doing? They're selling weapons to Israel. They're doing trade. They have commercial ties. They're even having cultural, educational ties with the occupied regime that has no regard for international law and human rights. How could they justify this?
Well, you have to ask them, but they are trying to say, what we're trying to ask them, since they claim that they support the two-state solution, that's their kind of natural, kind of default statement, we support the two-state solution. Well, a two-state solution means Palestine and Israel. Israel exists and it's one of this land. If you do believe in a two-state solution, why don't you recognize the state of Palestine? And then the state of Palestine as well will conduct negotiations with Israel on how to deal and how to manage the relationship between these two countries. But they refuse to do that. Only Sweden recognizes the state of Palestine. And when you ask the rest of the countries, you know, your own parliament passed a resolution recognizing the state of Palestine. When will you, the executive branch, recognize the state of Palestine? They say, well, we want to do it as a whole. We want to kind of have a power behind the declaration. So when we recognize it, it will actually produce some results. And they've been saying that for the last 20 years. Nothing. So they've not really tapped in on this idea of mass recognition. But at the same time, they're holding back in accepting what they're saying that they support, the two-state solution. Now, many Palestinians have stopped agreeing to the two-state solution, seeing what is happening, and that it must be more efficient for equal rights in a single state than to continue to go for the two-state solution. But the two-state solution has become a default, an easy statement that everybody can say. And even the Israelis say, we don't mind having something that Palestinians call a Palestinian state, but it will still have Israeli control on the borders, on the air, on the sea, on the water. But if you want to have a state, call it whatever you want. So what we want is a sovereign state that has control of its land and borders, and it's based on the 67 borders. That's what Palestinians want. And otherwise, Europe, as you said, is keeping up to its own core standards.
Now, Daniel, as you know, the world is grappling with this deadly pandemic. Even in this situation, Tel Aviv does not abide by the international conventions that oblige the regime as an occupying power to come up and provide residents of those areas it has usurped with badly needed pharmaceuticals and medical care. Sky's the limit when it comes to impunity for Tel Aviv, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Again, Israel is now engaged in a robust immunization program for Israelis, and they are not administering immunizations to Palestinians. Again, the long-time embargo against Palestine and other actions that have been done to destroy Palestinian water supplies, these are all contributing to COVID, the COVID spread in Palestine. And again, it's by design. The Israelis want to destroy the Palestinian people. I'm convinced of that. And again, that's why I tend to call this a genocide, not just apartheid.
I see. Now, Daoud, let's look at it from a different aspect. How far has Trump's Allah support emboldened Netanyahu and other Israeli officials to further expand the illegal settlements? You know, as you see, during the last days of Trump at the White House, they're even accelerating this process.
Yeah, well, Trump has done a few things since taking office. He moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem in defiance of international law. Defunded the UN refugee agency. Yeah, recognized the Golan Heights as Israeli territory, the annexation of the Golan Heights. And the worst part is that they declared a plan in which Israel is allowed to take one third of the Palestinian territories, and in return they give Palestinians a few enclaves in the desert. And they're saying this is basically they dictated. They wanted to dictate a plan on Palestinians in which they have to agree to give up one third of their land in addition to their capital, East Jerusalem, and then. So, and still Israel will control the borders in which they still call it a Palestinian state, but Israel will control all the borders. It was a sham of what's called the U.S. Trump vision of Palestinian policy, jokingly the deal of the century, but it basically has now failed as Trump in his elections. And I think Palestinians, like everybody else, are happy to see this man leave the political scene.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, how do you look at this? I mean, the different administrations at the White House, they have always supported the Tel Aviv regime doing whatever they wanted to do against the Palestinians. But the support that President Trump gave to the Tel Aviv regime has been, many believe that has been all out par excellence. Do you agree?
Well, of course. I mean, the fact that the U.S. has now under Trump recognized Jerusalem as being, you know, the capital of Israel. This is a huge sea change. Again, the cutting off of the aid to the Palestinian refugees. This is a unique thing in U.S. history. And frankly, yeah, this attempt by Trump, and successful attempt to get various countries in the region, including the Gulf states, to essentially turn their back on the Palestinian people, all these things are, you know, an incremental move towards Israel and, again, towards the ultimate abandonment of the Palestinians.
Daud, let's take a glance at the so-called Washington broker normalization deal signed by Tel Aviv recently in a number of Arab states. How big a role do those deals play in Israeli land grab policy and infringing on Palestinians' rights?
Well, let's dissect that. First of all, the four countries that have been involved in the normalization issue have had different levels of so-called normalization. The Sudanese have yet to approve the idea because their parliament has to meet and then they would approve it. The Moroccans have yet to also stipulate exactly what they plan to do, even though they've had some type of normal relations with Israel because of the Jewish Moroccans who live in Israel and who live in Morocco. So it has not been, of course, it was a stab against the Palestinians because the Arab countries committed that they would only normalize relationship with Israel once Israel withdrew from the occupied territory and agreed to a just solution of the refugee. So it weakened the Palestinian negotiating position. I don't think it has much to do. I mean, the Emirates have only like a million Emiratis, and Bahrain is like 800,000 people living in it. So they're two really tiny countries. I mean, they have a lot of money, but they're not really that big. Sudan is a big country, and so is Morocco. So those would be much more important. And in a way, that's why they've not come to the pressure, even though each one of them had a deal with the American. The Sudanese wanted to be lifted from the terror list, and the Moroccans wanted somebody to recognize their sovereignty over the Western Sahara. Mm-hmm. So, in the end, it is a setback, but it's not a big setback because, on the bottom line, Palestinians live in the occupied territories. They're there. They're not going anywhere. And sooner or later, Israel has to figure out a way to deal. You marry us or divorce us. You either give Palestinians equal rights or you let Palestinians have their own state. You either share the power or you share the country. You cannot have it both ways. And what is happening now is apartheid. It's having it both ways. Israel wants to control the land and it doesn't want equal rights to the people. And that's why we're having this two-tier legal system. And what is interesting about B'Tselem's report today is that an Israeli major, mainstream Israeli human rights organization saying, we're no longer going to separate between Israel activities in Israel and activities in occupied territories because it's a one country. Basically, it's one leadership that's deciding this apartheid system, and it has to stop. And so I tip my hands to B'Tselem It took them 50 years to come up with this decision, but it's good that they have come up with that. And I hope more and more Israelis understand what their government is doing.
Hopefully. Now, Daniel, Palestinians have been deprived of all their rights in the past several decades, as you know. Their lands and homes are stolen, and they're still being stolen and razed to the ground. They're denied an army to defend themselves. They're deprived of the free movement on their own land. The refugees are not allowed to go back home. They have no viable government. Some Arab states have betrayed them. So what choice and options do they have to see an end to this Israeli occupation and an end to their plight?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I think they are running out of options, not because of anything they've done, but because of Israel and because the world community, again, has largely abandoned them, as you say. I think what has to happen is for people in the United States and in Europe to show solidarity with the Palestinian people, to demand that Palestine be recognized, to demand the Palestinians be given their right. That is the only thing that can be done to help Palestine, is that the people of the West have to stand up for the Palestinian people.
Daoud, what do you think? What choice do the Palestinians have?
Well, you know, I think they do have a number of things. I mean, some of it is self-inflicted wounds of differences and disunity. So we're hoping that there will be elections on May 22nd in the West Bank in Gaza, and we can start recreating our own national unity. That's the number one. We need to have a unified Palestinian position. Secondly, we need to really work with the Palestinian diaspora and with the people of solidarity, like Daniel and others, to really enact the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. That has to really be the nonviolent tool that we have to use to force Israel to come to terms with the fact that it cannot live and control 5 million people against their will and deny the refugees the right to return. That has to change. And I think a boycott, divestment, and sanctions have to be used as a weapon, just like the South Africans used, to really get the world to put pressure on Israel to change its policy.
All right, on that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests. We had human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and also award-winning Palestinian journalist Daoud Kattab, who joined us from Amman, Jordan, with their comments and contributions. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and the program For Humanity, where we are discussing Imam Ali al-Sajjad's Risalatul Huquq, the Treatise of Rights. And at the moment, we are continuing on with speaking about the rights of your associates, those who you are in company with, those who you mix and mingle with. And there are many verses in the Holy Quran and traditions from Ahlul Bayt